Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Thanks for joining us. Get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy. It's really the only social media service I use these days. And you can find me and all my work at golfnewsnet.com. Also, download our apps for Amazon Fire and Roku TVs. And we are presented by 2Under. 2Under are the purveyors of asset management. They make the best darn underwear there is with their Joey pouch to keep your assets separate from the rest of your body, the no-drip tip, so that while you're out there on the golf course, you don't have wet shorts, basically. You know what I mean, if you've been there, especially if you have to relieve yourself in the middle of a round. And they also make, in addition to underwear that's great for golf, great for the gym, great for work, great for nighttime, whatever time of day or activity you're doing, they also make great loungewear that's extremely comfortable, good socks, and some other goodies as well. If you head over to 2under.com, the number 2undr.com, and use the promo code GNN20, you're going to save 20% on your entire order, whatever that might be. Again, 2under.com, the number 2undr.com, and the promo code is GNN20. I wanted to do an episode last week, and a bunch of things happened that kind of precluded that from happening, some good, some bad. In the bad and heartbreaking department, my 85-year-old grandmother, my dad's mom, passed away on Wednesday after a 6 to 7 year battle, depending on when you want to consider it starting, with Alzheimer's and dementia. I was really lucky to be able to spend some time with her basically the day before she died. And it was tough. I mean, she had been in a nursing facility. She had been dealing with hospice care, and she knows her name. She knew she was Miss Vi, Miss Violet, but she didn't really know our names. Dropped that a long time ago, and by and large, as probably some of you have gone through with perhaps your parents or grandparents, when they get into a nursing facility and they've dealt with Alzheimer's and Alzheimer's starts winning, it becomes very difficult to have a relationship with that person because they don't know you, and they might not know details about you from one minute to the next. And I'm just glad I went and spent some time with her and held her hand and tried to help make her as comfortable as possible in those last 48, 72 hours of her life. And I said this on my personal Facebook, which really the only time I ever post to Facebook is when there's a good anniversary or a death, unfortunately. But I said that I hope that there was a moment of clarity in there before she died, that she knew that the people who loved her were surrounding her, and that she knew who they were and what they meant to her, and that how much she was loved and how good she did. She always said, "You did so good." I remember her West Virginia drawl when she would say that when something good would happen in life, or she would come to your grandparents' day in my elementary and middle school, and we would sing for them and perform and all this stuff. She did good. She did real good. So that was the sad thing. The positive thing was a reaction to a piece I did kind of out of disgust about talking about it to my wife and myself so much. And it's on golfnewsnet.com if you'd like to read it. And that's kind of the point of this podcast, is the piece and the resulting reaction to it. So the piece is called Golf and the Struggle to Feel Like I Belong. And I've been talking about this with my wife a little bit, and part of it actually kind of came out of this just unrelenting feeling relating to playing Shinnecock Hills for the U.S. Open Preview Day. And we did a podcast on that, and hopefully you listened to it, and hopefully it gave some good insight to what the players might experience next week at Shinnecock. But I couldn't help but feel like I was out of place there, that I was playing a top five golf course in the world, and then when I would tell people about it, I almost kind of felt a little guilty. And I don't mean like that I'm in a better than you way, but like that I did it. That I almost sold out and did it. Went and played this amazing place, which was fantastic and wonderful, and the folks there could not have been nicer. But it went back to this prevailing feeling I've had for years, and it goes back to junior golf, that a middle class guy like me, and I'm still very much middle class, especially in the D.C. area where there are a lot of high earners and a lot of millionaires, the biggest cluster of millionaires in the country, I believe. And I just get this feeling even now that I don't entirely belong in golf, that this is not my sport, that people who come from my background don't play golf, or if they do, they play municipal golf. They don't belong to a country club. Fortunately, mine, I feel like, is more of a drinking club with a golf course attached to it. It's a true working man's club, and I love it. I talk about that in the piece. But if I didn't work in golf and I didn't have the time on my hands because of this job to be able to occasionally break away for a few hours during the day and play some golf or film reviews or whatever I need to do, I probably wouldn't belong to a country club. I would play municipal golf, and I probably wouldn't play that often. I would play, you know, enough to be okay and be happy and fulfilled, but I probably wouldn't do that on my own without being in the golf industry. And this sense that all these years later, I'm still dealing with this conversation I had about, you know, 22, 23 years ago, standing on the first tee of a junior tournament, getting ready to play, and one of the playing partners that day asked me what country club I belong to. I didn't. Didn't even fathom that idea. And I made one up, made up the name of one. I didn't know anything about country clubs, didn't know their names. I mean, now I know a bunch of them in the Baltimore, D.C. area, and I've been lucky enough to be invited to play to a number of those over time. And even still, I reckon with that conversation of, do I belong here if I don't have the money to do it? And the response is, and it's not just, the feeling I have is probably in a lot of ways self-imposed, or it's an intuition that I have, because I've never, and I've said this to a couple people, I've never had really a personal interaction at a country club. I mean, maybe a couple I've shoved deep in the back of my brain, but that felt personally, that I was being targeted by a culture or a person who felt like they were better than I am. It was just more of a sense that I got by being around these places, and that the pervading culture was a sense of superiority and exclusivity that just does not jibe with the way I see the world and the way I want the world to be. I am a do-gooder at heart. I mean, my master's degree is in public policy. I worked for a housing nonprofit for a handful of years during graduate school and out of school, where the mission and the goal was to find people affordable housing so that they could have the dignity of paying rent in a place where you wanted to live and that was respectful of your human dignity. And I still think about those things. I still think about that work and how sometimes I long to be able to do that work and to have a greater impact in the world than talk about golf, which I love so much. But sometimes I just wonder, what the hell am I doing? And that all kind of comes back to this feeling of, do I belong here? Do I belong here doing this with you? Do I deserve that? Or should I take whatever talents and gifts I have, cast that kind of recreational business to the side and go canvas and go change policy and go put some nails in boards and construct some things? And that's something I'm probably going to reckon with for as long as I'm in golf. But the reaction to the piece has been nothing short of overwhelming. I mean, I don't know what I expected people to say if they read it. First of all, I didn't expect many people to read it. I figured folks would think I'm some kind of snowflake who's been triggered by golf and would maybe not make fun of me, but just wouldn't respond in the way that they have. And it's been the total opposite. I mean, thousands of people have read the piece, which has been very nice, and I've gotten some really incredible feedback, heartfelt notes, from short to long. I mean, from folks in the industry, from folks who just love golf, from folks who work maybe tangential to golf or whatever. And some, you know, they've ranged from encouraging, which maybe was kind of missing the point. I mean, I love golf and I go to these places, so I guess I don't need the encouragement, but encouragement to, hey, I would love to play golf with you. I want to show you our club or where I play golf or my group of buddies. You know, we do it the way you imagine it, the way I describe my golf club, Argyle Country Club. We do it that way. We'd love to have you. And that was from Nebraska to Canada to right around here to a bunch of places in between. North Carolina, Brad Fritch, who was on the PGA Tour, actually on a suspension right now, but that's not really the point. I mean, he said, come down to my club near Raleigh, and we'll play, and you'll have a great time. And I would like to take him up on that, actually. The generosity that people have responded out has been wonderful, just because they want to tell you that you probably aren't alone in thinking this, and that there are places in the world, where, just like my club, where like-minded people to perhaps how I see the world play golf, have a great time, and don't do it with judgment. There's no air of superiority or elitism in it. And then there have been reactions, I mean, heartfelt, tear-jerking reactions from people who said, you know, I work in golf, or I've been in golf for a long time, and I've experienced a lot of the things you're talking about and found myself nodding my head the entire way through the piece, that's how I feel about it. And that, and maybe it's not a sense of belonging, maybe it's just that they feel overwhelmed by the sport, or that maybe the sport's out of touch. And the sense of belonging isn't necessarily the operative thing. I mean, you can feel like you belong and still feel like the culture doesn't fit, or all this stuff. I mean, don't harp on the word belong. But that the response was that some people within golf that maybe represent our sport, that are trying to get people to at least ostensibly take up the game, grow the game, that they're maybe not the best representatives for our sport. And by our sport, I mean the sport played by 90% of the 24 million Americans who play golf, or 23 million Americans, whatever it is. People who don't belong to top 100 clubs, or, I mean, hell, top 250 clubs, whatever it is, whatever your number. But these elite golf institutions that are more a cultural thing than necessarily a golf thing. I mean, in some places like Shinnecock, which is obviously a remarkable golf achievement, you know, both, but that the culture pervading those upper tier places speaks of privilege and aloofness and naivete about reality. And maybe that's blissful, but that they don't understand how the rest of us play golf, whether you belong to a private club or not, whether you play exclusively municipals, whether you pay good money out of your hard-earned budget to belong to a club because you want to get that volume discount of playing golf every week. Instead of paying for it on, you know, Golf Now, and there are benefits of being a member of a club that have way more to do with golf than the food or the people networking. I mean, I love that I can play my golf in 2 hours and 45 minutes like I did the other day, or that I can play with guys who are, and gals for that matter, who are great golfers and good people, and I know that they're there. You know, that's what I'm paying for with my golf club, but I'm sure I could experience that in other public places. But I think that's how the 90% engage in golf. And meanwhile, we've got people who live in that one, you know, the 10%, the 5%, the 1% world are the ones that are the spokespeople for our sport, and trying to tell everyone that golf's for them. And it just comes across as disingenuous, and it comes across as not believable that this person with a way too nice looking jacket and incredible cars and 3 club memberships wants Joe Schmo to go play Haynes Point Country Club, aka East Potomac Golf Course, and take up the game, and because it's just so great. And that the quality of design and quality of golf available at those places is nowhere near the places these spokespeople play. And honestly, I think we actually deal with that, and I'm probably going to make some folks upset in saying this, but I think we also deal with that to some extent, what's happening with the architectural revolution that we're kind of experiencing right now in pockets of the game, where the modern resort golf course is not a doldrum anymore of just wide and friendly to make you feel good. It's an architectural marvel in these far, far away places that are firm and fast and beautiful and amazing. They're all almost immediately top 100 courses, but for so many people, and that 90%, they're once in a lifetime opportunities, if never in a lifetime opportunities, to go play those places. And we talk about restorations and the great things that architects like Hance and Cord Crenshaw and Doak and DeVries and McCart, I mean, you go on the line of really, really good golf architects right now, and we're in this wonderful age where they're developing the occasional course, but they're riding the ship at so many of these kind of groundmark private places that none of us will ever play. and we boost that up, we talk about it, and then we kind of tease out to people the 90% again. This is the pinnacle of golf, and then we hardly ever talk about the incredible work done at Winter Park. That is a publicly accessible golf course. You can pay $19 to play world-class design at Winter Park or Goat Hill Park. That has kind of been a bit of a philanthropic effort, so to speak. But to take this seaside incredible golf course, this remarkable piece of property that's publicly accessible and totally affordable, and make it a great playground for beginners, for all golfers, for everybody. And we don't have a lot of those places. We don't have a lot of those things. The USGA has paid some lip service and a fair amount of money, I should say, a couple million bucks, to trying to get municipal golf courses back in the conversation of places to be restored to former glory, or to reach the glory that they were never given because they were developed lazily or they were neglected over time, like East Potomac Golf Course. We'll talk about that a little bit in a piece coming up. And that in so many cities around the country, the quality of golf could be so much better and so much more engaging with just a little bit of money. And I mean a little bit. I mean, Winter Park 9 was done with under $500,000. It was really a $250,000 project. And it transformed an incredible property into a destination in this little small town off of Orlando, off the 4. And I just think we don't talk about that stuff enough. We don't give it enough lip service. We also don't talk about what's really happening at a grassroots level. How are we getting? We talk about growing the game. How do we do that? Well, drive, chip, and putt. You know, people are taking up the game, or Topgolf. We got lots of people interested in playing a form of golf because of Topgolf, and those things are very nice. PGA Junior League is very nice. But are they getting people to play golf? Is the first tee? I don't know. I mean the evidence I have suggests not really. But we don't talk about the people who are doing the work on the ground to get them to try to get people to take up the game so passionately that they're willing to try to teach people this immensely frustrating game. And we don't talk to the people who are taking up the game. We don't tell their stories of, well, you know, here's how I got into golf, and here's why I love it, and I've transformed my budget so I can be able to play golf, we don't do that. We stick with talking to the people with deep pockets who buy clubs every year or every other year, who have a club membership. We're missing the point if we want to grow the game. If we talk about not even growing the game. If we just want to talk about golf how it really is, then we can't focus on these amazing destinations and top 100 clubs and so on and so forth. We can't do that because that's not how golf really is. That's not how it's really played. If we want to celebrate golf for what it is, we got to celebrate the golf you and I are playing. And if we did that, if we were more inclusive of that, if we all talk to each other in a more understandable, relatable, respectful way, I really do think golf would be in a better place. That if we could show people who didn't play golf that you didn't have to have a lot of money to be able to enjoy the game, you need obviously some, there's a minimum barrier to entry, but that you could find a club or a group that you could play with, whether that's private or you just kind of float around public courses, that there's a camaraderie here that doesn't have to have elitism or, frankly, snobbishness that can come from the kind of mysticism part of the game that talks about architecture and loves it and kind of wants to be indie in that sense of you want to be the first to deal with these places and see Winter Park. And I was there before it was this. And we can't do that either. That's also a point missing type of language. If we want to tell people golf is for everybody, then we've got to act like it. Got to talk like it. We've got to welcome people into the game, and this is a lifelong conversation I'm sure we're going to have if you're interested in this. But I would rather talk about the golf that is played every day, because that to me is just as magical as doing it on incredible real estate, whether that's in Michigan, Florida, Oregon, California, Arizona, the D.C. area, somewhere off the coast of Maine, whatever it is, Long Island and the Hamptons, whatever it is, the everyday golf is spectacular and wonderful, and it's an opportunity for people to get together and get exercise and have a laugh and challenge themselves. That is ordinary. I mean, there are 400 million rounds of golf played every year in this country, but the ordinary should be celebrated because it is spectacular compared to the alternative. If you get to spend 4 or 5 hours of your week or of a weekend or whatever, whenever you can play, playing golf, then you're doing something a lot of other people would probably love to be able to do if they knew what it meant. And we just don't tell them what it means. We tell them that it means, you know, it's hard and it takes a long time, costs a lot of money. But the people that I get to play with, especially municipal courses, I do go to them regularly. The people I get to play with at those places, I mean, they have had the same clubs for 15 years. They don't hit the ball any farther. They're probably not getting all that much better because they don't have that time. But they love to play golf. They love what it means for them, whether it connects them to their family or their friends or nature, whatever it is. And we don't really ever talk about that. We just, you know, we give people tips. You got to get better, or you got to buy this new equipment, or because those are things that pay the bills for advertising and all that stuff. I get it. We went to Ogle Bay Resort, West Virginia, in Wheeling, West Virginia. They're not sitting on a huge advertising budget. You know, they're not going to cut me a check for $10,000 so I can write a raving review and surround that with advertising about how much I enjoyed going to Ogle Bay, which is a reasonably priced resort in West Virginia that has three courses from three very different eras. I mean, the Depression era, the Jones course from 1970, that style of architecture is now kind of poo-pooed, and Arnold Palmer course from 2000. And then it's got a zoo for kids, which I loved, and very quaint accommodations that they're still working on because they don't have the money to be able to undergo a $50 million renovation every 20 years. They might have done it twice in resort history, renovated the whole place. I don't know, but we don't talk about those places enough because they're not sexy and don't have big budgets. But thousands upon thousands of golfers go to those places every year because it's relatively nearby, they can afford it, and that's not the point. The point is they get to play golf that's fun with their buddies, or with their wives and spouses, you know, whatever it is, a couple's trip, buddy's trip, solo trip. And we're just kind of like, yeah, it's fine. We don't need to talk about that. No, we do. Really do. And we talk about stuff that's expensive. I mean, really. We do two articles today on equipment. I did an article on the Rogue Pro Black Irons, which sound fantastic. They're a set of irons. Either in seven-piece or eight-piece, you know, $825 or $1,100, depending on which set you bought. That's not terribly expensive, but it's still a lot of money for most people. And it could take a summer of saving to be able to order that. And that's why you play those irons for 5 years or 10 years, because that's how it works for most people. And we did something on a beautiful ping putter, PLD3 putter. It's a limited edition putter. It's like $425. It looks amazing, but there aren't many people that can buy a $425 putter and either not have their spouse wring their neck or feel like they probably should have spent that on 3 months of cell phone bills. It's just, that's the reality. And I'm a big fan of confronting reality, that we have to face the things that are real instead of talking about the stuff that's not. And too often, in golf in particular, we're really good at putting on a face. We're really good at saying, you know, this has to be everybody. I mean, you get caught in a golf circle, it's very small, and it's very easy to forget what real golf is like. Oh, but you have to have seen. I mean, people have given me jaw-dropped reactions when I've told them I've never been to Bandon. Well, I've never asked to go to Bandon. I mean, I've never taken a free trip there. I don't know if that even is such a thing that exists. But for me, you know, I have two kids, two young kids. They're 5 and 2. I love them to death. I want to spend a lot of time with them. So that means going to Bandon with my wife, who doesn't play golf anymore, It's not necessarily a good family vacay, so I would have to do it on my own or with friends. And either way, again, you know, footing the bill, that's a $2,500, $3,000 affair. That's my kids' child care for the month. I don't save that much, especially the first year running this business full-time. Pretty much every dollar I have goes to paying somebody else and not doing something for me. Those opportunities are rare. And I have a feeling there are a lot more people like me, whether or not you're blue-collar, white-collar, whatever line of work that you're in, that are tight on those finances. So why am I talking about a place that, I mean, it's golf porn. I'm talking about a place that so many people will never be able to visit, never be able to afford, when I could also talk about places that are more reasonable, and that's why I love Myrtle Beach. It's reasonable to go there and stay. It's a reasonable vacation. There are 70 different golf courses. You can find literally every possible range of green fee, from $17 with a hot dog to $250 with caddy fee on top. You know, I like that. That's what I like about that destination. And I think that that's always been kind of the struggles. I've tried to grow GNN a little bit, and as we grow our travel stuff, I love the stuff that we put out. It's remarkable. The photography's amazing. The content's very good. But when we talk about these incredible places and these private clubs and stuff like that, it's kind of hard to see the audience for that. Like, oh, like I imagine reading as I do, like, oh, that sounds wonderful. I'll never go there. And that's why I like the work Eric Hart does for us. We're going to bring him on to write a little bit more frequently for us in a paid capacity, which I'm very proud of. And he writes great stuff from the perspective of having fun and being family friendly and being affordable, which is, that's real. That's real to me. I mean, that's probably real to you too. And I want to talk about real golf. I want to talk about golf, how it really is. We can talk about pro golf. We can talk about all the mystical places that so many of us are never going to be able to go unless it's on an incredible all expense paid trip. But I do want to talk more about how golf really is. So that's something we're going to commit to. It's something I tried to commit to when we first started doing Golf News Net. This is the fourth full year of me doing it. Even before then, when I was transitioning between Golf Channel and Back Nine Network, and between Back Nine Network and whatever the hell I was doing next, when I worked with Billy Casper Golf, I was trying to write about this kind of stuff, these stories and the visions of golf, and talking about golf in a way that really no one else was at the time. And then I realized probably be a good idea to have an audience of people who might want to read that, and committed the last 3.5 years of my life to doing that. And now we're at a point where I think that's possible. It's possible to tell these stories and maybe have some people pay attention. And that's what I want to do with it. And so I'm committing, in addition to trying to get these podcasts once a week or as close to once a week as possible, barring, again, circumstances out of my control, to try to put out once a week something, once a week to 10 days, that is not just fantasy or fantasy advice or tour related, just something about thoughts on golf, research on golf, something, a special place in golf that is accessible for people and is unique. Something along those lines. Something I would be interested in reading and wouldn't feel elitist about producing. So that's my goal. I did this podcast not to necessarily ramble about how I think golf should be, but I wanted to continue this conversation because I've had probably 15 or 20 different email threads or comment threads on LinkedIn with people who seemed to appreciate where I was coming from and want me to do more like that. And that I kind of want to do that with this podcast. I've ruminated on this, and so I want your feedback. But I've thought about not necessarily doing interviews with PGA Tour players or CEOs of companies. I mean, those people are very interesting in many cases, and they have cool stories to tell. But I wanted to share about golf the really interesting people I've met that aren't in those circles. I mean, they might work in golf, might have some hand in golf, but I want to talk to the people I've met because of golf that maybe don't work in golf. And they might be famous, they might not be, they might just be interesting, but I want to do something about that. I want to talk to and about the people that really interest me. From 18 holes together, from working together, whatever it is. So I'm going to commit to do that. Hopefully we can do that over the course of the summer, a few weeks away from the official start of summer. So that's something I want to get rolling on and trying that. It won't be every week. It'll be here and there, but that's what I would like to do in getting people on this show. And we'll throw in the occasional tour player as they're available, or CEO if they have something interesting to say. But I want to have real, genuine conversations on this show. I don't want it to be about fitting in plugs or promoting products necessarily, you know, unless it's something that person came up with themselves. And I find that story interesting. So let me know your thoughts on that. You can hit me up on email, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Twitter, again, at Ryan Ballengee, RyanBallengee. And I'd love to hear from you, honestly, whether you thought this was the dumbest show you've ever heard or whether you agree. Because I think it's time, based on the reaction I've gotten to this, I think this is an important conversation. It's going to be a long one, but it's an important conversation. And if this got the ball rolling in any possible way toward getting people to feel who are inside this game more like they belong and that they have a place and they don't need a facade, or for people who aren't playing this game, that they're welcome and we want them and we want to enjoy your company, that's important too. All right, that's going to do it for us on this episode of the show. We'll try to come back a little bit later on in the week and talk about some pro golf stuff and some things that are interesting. I mean, Bryson DeChambeau won. He's an interesting dude. We'll talk about him. Arya Jatanyagarn won the U.S. Women's Open in stunning fashion, in a variety of ways stunning. And that deserves some conversation as well. So until then, I'm Ryan Ballengee saying thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.